teleportation is a great way to feel energized and alive. But I hear the technology is still a little buggy. So in the meantime, just stick to coffee. An easy choice when you can pick Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, but the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this outstanding coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it so that it always reaches you guaranteed fresh and you will taste the difference that fresh beans make. And if you like life hacks, you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club. It's completely flexible and customizable, all the convenience with none of the commitment. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 20% off your next coffee order. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Don't be afraid of Sparkplug. Don't be very afraid of Sparkplug.
TOP 100.
TOP 100.
TOP 100.
Project.
Hi there, film freaksters, and thanks for clicking that play button to hear the 395th Ellis's Analysis. We review good, great, and sometimes not so great motion pictures from long ago, and we spoil the guts out of them. We also spoiled all 123 AFI classics on their 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists so long ago. I'm the twitchy brunette who will never change the world as we know it, but I sure find it tempting to wear the exact same outfit every day, Ryan Ellis. And here's the sickly beast who loves to eat sugar, water, sugar, and has yet, to my knowledge, snapped a guy's arm in half during an arm wrestling match, my wife Bev.
To your knowledge.
It's a scene I couldn't watch for the longest time. I did watch it this time. I've seen it so many times, I guess I've been desensitized, but it is vivid and therefore disgusting.
You feel your own arm breaking. It's really good special effects, and that shot especially. It's too real.
George Shavallo, former Canadian boxing champion, plays that character, and this movie was shot, and I think effectively set, in Canada. We see the CN Tower, we see a lot of Canadian, maybe not landmarks, but if you know this city back in the mid-80s, you'd recognize this over and over again, and this is a David Cronenberg specialty, to shoot up here and to not try to make it look like it's New York or anywhere else in America, to make it look like, basically, it is in Canada. If it matters, maybe it doesn't really matter in some cases, maybe it does in others, but he almost always shoots up here, and he certainly did this time.
Do they ever name the city where they're meant to be? They never do name the place.
I don't believe so.
Yeah, I guess conceivably it could be Toronto, because when you see CN Tower, what other city could it be? They'd made no attempt to hide it.
In the mid-80s, it was one of the most famous tall buildings in the world. It's been overshadowed by a lot of buildings since, but not so much then.
We had a claim to fame once.
It was the tallest freestanding structure in the world for many years, but it's been passed by several since. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's sci-fi month. We're going to do four sci-fi films and the coming attractions opinion question for the first one, The Fly. If Seth's teleporter hadn't turned him into a hideous beast and we could actually use his invention to travel around the world, anywhere you want to go, in a blink of an eye, where's the first place you'd want to go?
So I guess you have to travel from teleporter to teleporter. It's not like I could teleport into like a bank vault or something.
No, right? You're right. You're ruining it, but you're right.
Because that would be my number one. And then I guess my number two would be someplace like New Zealand. Someplace where the flight is like 20 hours long.
Being there is far better than actually getting there, which
or
is always
like
true for
the
traveling.
Moon. Somewhere with terrible travel times.
So much to do on the moon. So many sights to see. Well, my answers are George Clooney's villa. We recently saw him on Last Week Tonight, but I thought of this anyway before we even saw that episode. Or after a year plus of lockdown, anywhere but here. Anywhere but here.
Yeah.
And we do like this city where this movie was shot and I think set. You're right, though. The teleports, the telepods would have to be at the other end.
Yeah. Yeah.
Damn you, Ellis. Your accuracy. All right. The Ugliest Scientist Ever was released by Brooks Films and 20th Century Fox 35 years ago on August 15th, 1986. The film was number one at the North American box office for two straight weeks in August that year, and then went on to make four times its budget worldwide. So obviously it was a success, and especially by Cronenberg standards, who's not exactly Michael Bay incarnate. Can't say reincarnate, because he was before Michael Bay, and he's a much better director than Bay anyway. We've done him several times. History of Violence in the past for Cronenberg. We did that one. We did The Dead Zone. And now maybe his most famous movie of all. But please, because the movie's 35 years old, Bev, you might want to remind people what this is about. So give him the skinny. On the Fly.
Jeff Goldblum is the brilliant and strange scientist Seth Brundle, who has cracked the secret to teleportation in his private lab. One night, spurred by romantic jealousy and scotch, Brundle puts himself through the machine to test it. Only he doesn't notice that there was a fly in the chamber with him, and the machine, confused, blended their DNA. Brundle slowly begins to change, grotesquely mutating into a fly-human hybrid, becoming more desperate and dangerous with each passing day.
Fly in the ointment. Or, in a nutshell, journalist uses her ex-boyfriend's shotgun to murder her current boyfriend.
Yeah.
One of the most tragic endings to any horror movie of all time. Almost has brought me to tears in past viewings of this movie.
Yeah, part of the power of the film is the success of the romance. It's like a romantic tragedy as much as it's a horror film.
Which I think Cronenberg would agree with for sure. The body horror. And then, of course, the love story. And as great as Jeff Goldblum is in this, and probably should have been recognized at the Oscars, or at least could have been, Gina Davis, this time especially I noticed, has to carry the second half of the film more than he does, because as much as he has a hard job and all that makeup, that tragedy, that sorrow, that making you want to cry at the end of a horror movie is on her.
It could so easily be that cliche role of the woman who's just there to be the cipher for the audience, to cry so that the audience knows how to feel. But she really does transcend it. So much credit to her and to Cronenberg and to the screenplay, too, for making her a real, whole character with her own stuff going on, including the ex-boyfriend and the pregnancy. She's so complex, and her reactions to his transformation bring so much depth to the film.
And people talked about how this was a metaphor for AIDS, but Cronenberg didn't intend it that way, because when it was being rewritten by him, he didn't write the original script. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But when he rewrote it, AIDS wasn't that world famous, I don't think, especially probably up here in Canada. He was thinking more about the metaphor for aging or just having cancer. And of course, Goldblum calls it that at one point. It's like a form of cancer. And then how you deal with that. Somebody you love has quickly gone downhill, and yet you want to be with them. And then they also, at the same point, are disgusting and go a little nuts.
I would say there's also this theme of when you fall in love with somebody and you think you know them, they're one kind of person. But once they have you, they turn into a different person and a kind of monster. She has this terrible ex-boyfriend who we meet, who breaks into her apartment, who's rude to her and tries to control her. And then she meets somebody who seems to be the opposite, who's kind and goofy in his own way, but they have this really beautiful love story. Their chemistry is real. They were a real couple.
Goldblum and Davis were, yeah.
Yeah. But that doesn't always translate on screen. But on screen, they have so much chemistry, but also they seem like a sweet couple that you root for a lot.
Interestingly, the men reverse roles.
Totally.
Stathis is awful in the early part of the movie, and yet he becomes a heroic character who is looking out for her as much as anything else in the last half or so, last third anyway. And because of what's going on with him, it's not his fault, Seth Brundle becomes the bad boyfriend, who does break into her abortion clinic, not her place. He does some of the things Stathis does early on, and Stathis does some of the things that Brundle did later on.
And it doesn't feel cheap. I guess Stathis gets a real pass at some point when he goes from the hero to the villain. Maybe he could have been a little more fleshed out as a character to understand that he had that complexity at the beginning, because they just kind of make him a little bit mustache twisty in the first act. But I do buy it. Once she's in genuine peril, and she's not just this person that he's toying with and messing with, once she's in danger, he gets right down to her level. He suddenly just switches gears and he cares, and he never goes back to that crummy boyfriend again. And it's another interesting, complex level to the story. It could so easily have gone with just these archetypes, and it could have just so easily been a B-movie. If you look at the story on its face, it's kind of ludicrous. You read the plot on Wikipedia and you're like, this movie sounds so stupid. But when you're watching it, you get incredibly invested, and these are all the little touches that elevate it. There are probably hundreds of thousands of creature films that are just forgettable, fun, different kind of movie, but Cronenberg and the cast and the script make this movie something really special.
It is based on the 1958 original movie, which was based on, well, not original, I guess, because it's based on George Langelin, two A's at the end, so maybe it's Langelin's short story. And that is the basis for all of the adaptations of The Fly and the sequels. There were two sequels to the 1958 one, and there's one sequel to this one a couple of years later that the makeup guy directed. But there's never been another movie based on this, a remake or anything. I think it surprises a lot of the people, including Cronenberg, involved with this, even if they weren't to be involved. You'd think that they would do one, CGI, you'd probably go too far and make it less believable. But it just seems incredible they haven't done that, because this did succeed. I think the original one did too. And there's such good meat on this bone. Because it's so absurd, and yet this basically makes it feel like, yeah, I can get into that. And I certainly was into this, like I've always been into this movie. I liked it from the first time I saw it. I like it about the same amount now.
I definitely like it better every time I watch it. I think the first time I saw it, maybe because it felt dated and I didn't know what to expect. I don't think I really loved it the first time I saw it, but every time I watch it, I'm pretty impressed with how mature it is, how invested you are in these characters. And you said about the performances already, they're so outstanding. Really, mostly Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum. There's practically only three characters in this movie. The two of them and John Getz, who plays Stathis. There's other characters, but nobody else that really seems to matter.
The only other actors I've made note of are George Chivallo, the guy he has the arm wrestling match with, and Joy Bouchel, who's Tawny. She wanted to do Look Who's Talking a few years later, the same year, actually, that the sequel to this came out. The Fly 2 came out in 1989, and so did that. And then Cronenberg is the gynecologist. There are some other actors here and there. The guy who plays the abortion clinic doctor very briefly, but that's pretty much it. And this should be, and it was turned into an opera, but this should have been a stage play, because it'd be so easy to make it from a cast standpoint anyway.
Well, I'm not sure how they would have pulled off the metamorphosis. Although, whatever, they made Lion King into a stage play, so I'm sure they could figure something out.
There's Bradley Cooper,
creative people who could do it.
Bradley Cooper did the Elephant Man, and apparently it was just a physical thing that he did with his body, and I saw a little snippet of that when that was coming out. They didn't put, that I recall, makeup on him.
No.
It was just him doing physical stuff, so if you get an actor obviously as good as he is to do that, okay, The Fly is even more elaborate, but put makeup on him and have him do that kind of stuff, it would be believable.
And in this film, Goldblum and Davis, we give them credit for these wonderful performances, but truly just for, like, never faltering their commitment to make this world real for us.
So the numbers, we haven't talked about that, and we're about 10 or 15 minutes into this thing. Rotten Tomatoes critics, 92% of them said A-okay about this movie. 8.4 out of 10 as an average and a good sample size, so that is a pretty accurate number. It's not like 10 people reviewed this movie. And 83% of audiences. The 1958 original got good reviews too, but the 1989 sequel was scorched by the critics on Rotten Tomatoes. 29% and 24% critics and audiences. This movie, 1986's Fly, was 23rd that year at the box office. Platoon was number 3. We covered that for the Top 100 Project many years ago, and it won Best Picture. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, one of the more famous movies of that year, was 10th. We covered that way back when. And Stand By Me, which we also covered in another very famous movie from that year, and two of my favorites, I guess, Ferris Bueller, Stand By Me, and Platoon and The Fly, for that matter. But Stand By Me was 13th, and all these movies now are in our archives somewhere, probably way back when. This won the Oscar for Chris Wallace's outstanding makeup. They could have nominated for visual effects, I guess, too, although I guess they just lumped it into one thing. And it is, as we've talked about in previous Cronenbergs, one of the few movies that ever even got a nomination of any kind for a Cronenberg film, and the only one that's ever won anything. History of Violence got a couple nominations, and Eastern Promises got an acting nomination. So two acting nominations in Cronenberg films. Viggo in Eastern Promises, William Hurt in History of Violence, the screenplay for History of Violence, this for the makeup, and I think that is all ever for a very underrated, but of course Canadian, low-budget,
horror
and weird type of director like Cronenberg. But no nominations for the two actors, especially Goldblum. He would have been recognized if either of the two of them would have been, between him and Davis.
And we haven't talked about his physicality, of what he does when he's on the canes, when he's in the makeup and he's acting like a bug.
And he also has to go from being a gymnast type. They got a gymnast to perform a lot of the things that he does. Pretty decent hair on him. And, well, the body, we can believe, is Goldblum's because he got in shape for this movie. You see him topless. And you don't focus on his back or his lats or those kinds of things, which are probably better than Goldblum's. But we saw what he looked like. It's not like he looks like me and then suddenly he's a gymnast body doing those things. So that's believable. But sometimes what really betrays a stunt like that is somebody not having a good enough hairstyle that matches the actor. And this one, I think, did. But he does all those things early on to show off for Ronnie. And then he goes downhill, but then he can climb on the walls upside down. We'll get to that in a second, how they did that. But then later on, he's going downhill again. He's on canes and things. Then he's able to jump through a window of an abortion clinic. Great jump scare. Carry her off onto the roof of a building. She's not really struggling, but she probably would have at some point. And he's able to overpower somebody who's also pretty tall. She's 6 feet tall herself and so cute. Yeah. Gina Davis is a beautiful woman and a great actress and all those things. And of course, she's a towering person. But in this movie, especially, she's so early on, cute.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's got those physical talents that come and go through the movie. Maybe that's part of what a fly's life cycle is like. I don't think that would make a lot of sense. But maybe that's also part of the logic of having cancer, or, again, the AIDS metaphor, which doesn't really apply to what Cronenberg intended. or just being sick in general. You have your good days and your bad days. And in this case, the good days are, I can climb upside down on the walls, and the bad days are, I can barely get around, and I'm almost incapacitated.
I took the cane thing as more like, he feels more comfortable walking on four legs now, rather than upright like a human. So he's kind of using the cane as prosthetic legs for the front of him, okay, rather than like he's hobbled like a cripple.
He looks like he's hobbled, as if he's a cripple, though.
That's true. And his performance in that scene looks like he's in pain.
But not being consistent is also fair in a sci-fi movie about something that's never happened and will never happen. So if he's got the talents and the abilities and the strength one day and then not another or a week or two later, you can get away with that because we don't know what this would actually happen because it isn't real. I didn't quite finish with the plaudits, though. So AFI-wise, it got four different nominations. Top 100 Thrills. There are some good thrilling moments. Top 100 Passions. I wish they'd put this on there as a different kind of romance than all the rest of them, because you have so many of the obvious romances from the 30s and 40s on that Passions list. The Top 100 Genres in the Sci-Fi category. Really good list. I wouldn't have bumped anything off, but this was at least worthy of getting nominated. And the Top 100 Quotes, probably the best of these four, be afraid, be very afraid. What a great quote. It's been said so many times, and as people point out who made this movie, the average person probably has no idea. It's from The Fly.
Is it from the original Fly, too?
Well, that original quote is, help me!
Oh, yeah.
Help me! Which is homage in this movie when Goldblum asks her in his fly guise, it's one of the last things he ever says when he's captured her and taken her up the roof. I think that's when he says it. Help me, will you help me? That kind of thing. But it's not played for camp. It's played for dead seriousness. We're probably 15 or 18 minutes into this podcast and I haven't asked you what you thought about the movie. I like it a lot. I already said I'd give it at least an 8. What about you?
It's not the world's most elegant film. I actually always think that Cronenberg, his movies, in my opinion, don't always have the best flow, especially inside a scene. And it takes a little clumsy path sometimes to get to the good stuff, like that Footloose-inspired gymnastics that we were talking about. But it is also worth it to get to that demented, ruthless body horror in the third act and to just see the film come together as a whole.
Well, speaking of the body horror, I assume this is what he meant, but Vincent Price, who did star in the original 1958 movie, said he liked it a lot, but thought it went too far. I'm not sure what he meant exactly, but probably when it gets to the point of him, meaning Goldblum, puking on his food, but then even more so. And why wouldn't he do this, actually, as a defense mechanism, as a weapon, puke on John Getz's left hand and then one of his feet, and he's about to puke on his face before Ronnie stops him. It might as well be that he's throwing literal acid in his face, because that is effectively what he's doing to this poor man who's now deformed. And John Getz, incidentally, is the only one of these three actors that was in the sequel. They have footage of Goldblum they shot for this. I don't know if he shot it separately. I think it was from this and it was outtakes they didn't use that they show on a video camera. Because, of course, Martin Brundle, so Ronnie is pregnant in this movie, and she does apparently have the baby in the sequel, and that is Eric Stoltz playing him. But John Getz is the only one of these three actors that actually has any real screen time in that sequel. And of course, it isn't really canon because that's a sequel that these filmmakers had nothing to do with.
Cronenberg's never made a sequel to any of his movies.
Most of his movies don't really set up for sequels. This one did. History of Violence. You could do a sequel to that because, like we said in that one, the big bosses in Philly, William Hurt's bosses, he talks about those guys, Joey. Well, Joey got away with killing his brother and a lot of other people, but those bosses may want to come back for revenge, and they probably know that it was this Joey guy who got away from them 20 years ago, and now he's Tom, whatever his name is, in the Midwest. That could have had a sequel, but this is the most logical one for that. You haven't seen it, though, have you?
No.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the very first scene in this movie, after the opening credits, which are pretty coolly done with the big music by Howard Shore, big and loud, is Seth talking to Ronnie about how he'll change the world. A line he says many times in the early part of the film, especially because of his telepods. And then she goes back to his lab. A lot of movies would have this happen, maybe in the first few scenes, but it would be 10 minutes in, not a minute and a half, 2 minutes in,
yeah,
where she's back in the lab. It is business at this point. It is her job as a journalist to see what he's talking about. And she's also into him, I guess, and he's into her, but it's not really about that at that point. He plays the piano for her, so you got this combination of an artistic talent with this scientific talent. He teleports a stocking with that old computer, so quaint and cool-looking, 1985-ish. Well, probably older. It would probably have been an early 80s computer he's using. But those kinds of click, click, click keys, which I guess we still had several years after that, but definitely takes you back. And I like how he gives credit to the people who helped build these telepods. He farms out the work like Batman does. So he is a brilliant scientist, but it's not like he's saying, oh, I made this. He did make it, in a way, but at the same point, so did everyone else involved. So if he was like a film director up on stage, he'd be saying, yeah, I just won Best Picture or Best Director. But here's this guy, and that woman, and that person who helped me make it. It's not just, oh, I made this by myself, which is a nice touch. I like that.
Yeah, he's a scientist, but he's also just kind of a project manager. We say scientist, he's an engineer, because he did engineer these things. Not really.
I think scientist fits
well. I guess there's experiments that go on to figure out what works and what doesn't, but yeah, it's how design actually works in the real world.
And he says he wouldn't have shown a journalist if she had tried to report on it and do a whole piece about it. And that's BS, because he wanted the publicity, and he also likes her.
Well, he wants the publicity after he goes through the machine.
He wants it before that.
Well, this is a great theme in the film, too, because you can say the teleporting and the turning into a fly, it turns him into a bad person. It brings out this villain in him. But was there a villain in him just waiting to come out? In a way, did the fly make these latent tendencies in him emerge?
Yeah, I think so. And like we say, he has the reverse arc of Stathis, because he gets worse as the movie goes on, but Stathis gets better as it goes along. And maybe people who see the film now would not forgive Stathis for what he did in the past and breaking her place to shower and all that kind of thing and making some of the suggestions he makes to her about, let's just have a casual thing. It's not the end of the world what he suggests to her. They were involved before, but it is a great arc. And I think that's one reason why John Getz took the part, was because he was the yuppie scum, but he evolves. And Seth, yes, probably does have some kind of villain inside of him, but then we all do. Who is the nicest person that you know? We've mentioned her before, actually, in fairly recent months. Val. Our friend Val.
Yeah.
But if she went through this, would we see some dark stuff inside of her?
I don't know. I'm trying to picture it now.
Maybe not her.
Struggling, yeah. She might be the exception.
We talk about body horror, and obviously that's mostly about what Seth goes through. But what about the baboon that gets exploded?
Oh, my gosh.
Turned inside out, effectively. Of course, Scousey Quest. It's inside out. And it exploded. When they teleport something from a planet. But then when Seth makes it work later on with the baboon, who hangs around with him for a little while, a lot of things happen in a short period of time, it feels like, in this movie. I guess weeks do transpire. He does say that at one point. But in the early stages, it feels like it's a matter of days, because he makes that happen and she has to go off to take care of things with Stathis. And what she means is, I need to get this guy out of my life and really finally say that that's the end of this relationship. But he's jealous, just like Stathis is jealous of Seth. That's hard to say fast. Stathis.
Well, I wonder if their names are similar on purpose.
Probably. Also weird names. Stathis especially, but even Seth is not the most common film name. And then Seth is drinking alone, goes through the pod, naked, except with the fly, of course. And it would have worked, obviously, just perfectly fine had it not been for the fly. Now, I was reading online, there's so much trivia about this movie. But people have raised the question about why didn't the steak and the plate merge when he did that teleportation? Because when the stocking goes through, it's just a stocking. That's one thing. Okay, fine. Also, people point out when even he goes through, or the baboon, what about the bacteria or the fleas on the baboon's body?
The contents of your stomach.
True. But that is inside of you. But I thought about this in prepping for the podcast just today. The plate and steak thing especially, because, of course, later on, he gets merged with a completely inanimate object. When he's merged with the telepod at the very end, when he is a full-on fly. So why wouldn't the steak and the plate be one thing? Well, he has to teach the teleportation, the computer, I guess, really, the flesh, as he says a few times in the film. And you could say, okay, he did that, so why didn't it merge? Well, he keeps working at it, obviously, so maybe he made it work once, but he's got to make it work even differently as he goes along. So for whatever reason, when it's a more primitive version of this teleportation device, it can keep those two things separate. But then when he makes it more elaborate, it, for some reason, in that sense, can't.
I mean, if you really want to get hung up on the science of it, let's talk about how a man who, I think he says he weighs 185 pounds, I don't care how sticky your fingers are. Part of the reason flies can hang upside down on the ceiling is because...
They weigh nothing?
They weigh nothing.
True, yeah. Well, I guess another comparison here is Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
fair. And he does ask the computer early on when he can still speak to the computer, too. And, of course, he's typing a lot of the time. Did he just absorb the fly? Which is also what he probably should have done, something that little. But the whole thing with the bacteria, by the way, people make this point online, if I didn't say this already, that's basically just part of your body. The fleas in a baboon, that's a little tougher to...
But the bacteria has genetic code in it, and there are little mites that live on our eyelashes and stuff. There's animals that live within us. It's
I have
just
heard
bacteria.
There's an epic amount of bacteria just in your belly button. Never mind your nose, which also a ton, or your mouth. Well, before he does go through with the fly, when she's left to take care of things with Stathis, that's when we find out he wears the same outfit every day, and he talks about how that is what Einstein did.
It is.
And I mentioned in the beginning about how I'm a little envious of that. Not that I wear clothes that are that different every day, but I don't wear the exact same thing every day.
Tell you, during the pandemic, I've had a rotation of about 7 shirts and like 3 pairs of pants.
That's more than a lot of people have had.
Maybe. I don't care if they match.
And you know what? Speaking of the pandemic and, of course, teleportation. I forget what it was, but we talked about this about a year ago when the pandemic was just starting and we realized we were in for longer than we thought, more than a few weeks at least. And I said somewhere in one of our podcasts, Total Recall, that's what it was, a virtual vacation. You don't have to go anywhere. It's safer. It does cost less. But your brain thinks you really went somewhere. And I said that could be the future of vacations if they could ever make that actually happen. These telepods could actually literally take you to the place, so you are going to go there rather than having a Total Recall thing in your head. But if these things could be made real and you have enough of them, maybe you don't have hundreds of them, but you have about 100 of them, and you have to get down to the Caribbean, but then maybe take some kind of flight somewhere that's an hour away. It's not likely to ever happen. I've never heard anything about this. But this could be the future of travel, especially for things like vacations.
Would you ever get one of those things, though?
I wouldn't be the first.
No, of course not. I wouldn't be the millionth. I don't think I could do it. I'm convinced that it would be a copy that would emerge on the other end and not me. I would die and then a brand new exact copy of me would show up.
So the prestige.
Else. Yes, totally the prestige. I just would never get in a teleporter.
I don't know if I would, but I'm not as against it as you are.
I don't think we're in danger of getting in a teleporter in our lifetimes. In order to teleport something like a human size, it would take almost all the electricity that the planet produces.
Think about how that will work even just in this house, or in this area, maybe not this house, but this area, with all the different waves in the air, the microwaves and the cell phone waves, and I can't even think what all this stuff is, from here to, I don't know, 50 houses away from us, just that far. Would that be a clean signal? Could you rely on a clean signal, let alone to go cities away or states away or continents away? But one of the reasons why Seth is doing this, because he says to Ronnie early on, she thinks he's had too much to drink, but he says, no, I just get motion sickness. So he doesn't like traveling very much. And he doesn't really travel much in this movie. He's walking most of the time he ever goes anywhere. And he's in the car with her probably more than once, but I think we only really see it once.
So that's his origin story. That's why he had to build a... Because he got car sick.
Well, this would make him, because he obviously wants to be known. I don't think he wants to be rich exactly. Probably would love that too. Who doesn't want to have money? But I think he'd really just like to invent something awesome and have the notoriety more than anything else. And if this thing ever actually worked, and even could just do some things, maybe it doesn't take you down to the Caribbean or to France from here, but take you somewhere else, maybe an hour away, and then you build to going further as the decades go on. A person who built that would be world famous.
I feel like the true value of something like that would be more about transporting goods. If you could eliminate the shipping charges of sending things between China and here.
Then you're going to take our jobs.
Yeah, we'd take our jobs.
Those drivers. But yeah, Seth does finesse the pod to learn about the flesh, the baboon teleport works. Then he goes through, all that stuff ends up happening. But he thinks that he's been made special because he went through. And then he starts talking extremely fast when he's drinking coffee, faster than me. Goldblum improvised quite a bit of that dialogue, I guess, in his Goldblum-y way. But through about half of the movie, he wants Ronnie, and then for that matter, briefly, Tawny, which is what leads into the, I'm afraid.
Oh, Tawny and afraid. Ronnie rhyme, too.
Right. Yeah. And she says, I'm afraid about going through. And he says, don't be afraid. Then you have the famous quote. So three people say the word afraid four times in about 5 seconds. But he wants Ronnie to go through, obviously separately at first. And then at the very end, when he's really over the deep end, he wants to go through with her when he knows that she has a baby, so they'd all be one creature. Which I remembered from before, but I forgot how absolutely clear he makes that he wants to be one creature with her, and as he just learned earlier that night, the baby inside of her.
Yeah.
But also, understandable motivation from anybody, don't kill me, the last human part of me is what's inside of you, don't do that. But she has that terrible nightmare of the maggot baby being born, Cronenberg's the gynecologist in that dream. Apparently the last bit of this movie, the ending, could have been her having another dream, but then it's a beautiful butterfly inside of her, which is also weird because you want to be a human baby, but I get the metaphor. But as it's pointed out by a lot of people, including, I think, Cronenberg, the story's over. End it. You start with the two of them talking, and like I said, they're in the lab in minutes. And then when she blows his head off, the fly version of him, the story's over. If they'd had another bit, a little breathing moment there, it wouldn't be as effective. I've seen the deleted scene. It's well done. It's fine. But you do end on the right note because she's crying, fades to black, credits. Break people's hearts in a horror movie. That is not easy to do. And you probably would ruin that moment if you had a sweet moment of her realizing, oh no, I am pregnant with his child, but it's going to be fine. But then the question becomes, did she get pregnant when he was still just Seth or when he was Brundlefly?
Not worth the risk. Have right. The abortion.
And a movie that also says that word, schmishmortion, they never really say it in Knocked Up, which is 21 years later. And that movie's, well, for a little while, he says so much about that. Juno, I think, maybe literally says it, but not much. Again, a movie that doesn't dwell on it too long. But those two movies, the same year, do bring that topic up, and they also skirt around using that word. This movie does say, I want an abortion, I want it out of me, making it very clear why. Well, they'd find a way, but the pro-life people would have a harder time with this situation if this was real than if it was just Joe Average and Jill Average wanting an abortion.
That is something that's changing, because I can think of three movies off the top of my head where the happy ending is basically a woman getting an abortion. Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. Grandma, is that what that movie was called, with Lily Tomlin?
And Julia Garner?
Yeah, and Swallow, that was another one. The happy ending is a woman who gets to have an abortion, isn't stuck with the wrong person's baby. I love the touch that she is pregnant with a baby. It fits so well into the body horror thing, and Cronenberg does this so often, and I think he's always really fascinated with the horror within. To him, the monster is not something you can run away from. It's something that's inside of you and corrupting you, whether it's mental illness or what Brundle's going through or a baby that could be a monster. This is a theme he comes to over and over again, and it's part of what makes his films not just scary, but really very unsettling.
And creepy.
It's creepy, and there is just something about it that's not fun horror. It is unnerving.
And of course, Seth has his collection of body parts in the bathroom. The first time he really truly sees what he's starting to look like, when he's still basically normal, but he's starting to go downhill a little bit. He's got lesions on his face and that kind of thing. But then he's starting to feel worse, and he says, am I dying? Is this what it feels like to start dying? Something like that. But as it goes along and he has the full bodysuit, he's got this whole collection of his body parts, which aren't dwelled on, but that's pretty gory and creepy too. It's more the sadness than the horror that this guy's going through with this. And why is he keeping these parts? For the shot, really. But also because he's a scientist or an engineer, whatever you want to call it. Maybe he thinks that these things can be analyzed. Okay, what happens next? Very easy one. How do Ronnie and Stathis explain this crime scene to the police? How do they possibly explain the specifics of what's in there, including what's in his bathroom, all his body parts, which they probably would analyze and realize, that's an ear. Those are teeth. Why is this in here? Why is he keeping this? That wasn't a person that she killed, clearly. It's some kind of, they wouldn't realize it's a fly, but some kind of weird-looking creature. What do they say to the cops? And as I said, John Getz is in the sequel, and she's not, but what happens next?
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that the plot of the 50s version of The Fly starts with the cops coming across a grisly scene, and then the scientist's wife in that film, it's his wife, has to explain all the events that happened that forced her to basically kill her husband.
In that movie, the basic idea is the two creatures swap heads. So that's why it's, help me, with this little squeaky voice. He's a tiny head on a little fly in a spider web, about to be eaten by a spider. But the man, the scientist, has a fly head, and I think also a fly arm.
Yeah, he has a fly hand.
But that's as far as that one goes. And still pretty weird and creepy for the 50s. Nothing as elaborate as this. If they did remake this movie, you know it would be CGI, primarily, if not entirely. I don't know if I'd want to see that, because they would go so far off the top. He would fly, which also makes some sense. He never does grow wings like he probably should. He doesn't look that much like a fly at the end as well when everything bursts through. It's funny, too, that he's still able to speak mostly like himself. The computer doesn't recognize his voice towards the end of the film, which really hurts his research. And see the look on his face, which is, I've lost everything now if I can't even do my scientific job. And he is trying to reverse all this process. He wants to use Ronnie to go through the teleport to use her DNA. He thinks that would actually just turn him back to normal. It's not about, let's make one whole creature. That's at the very end. But he's still talking to her. He's certainly understandable when he has this plan about merging the three of them, including the baby inside of her, into one creature, and she pulls his jaw off, and then the fly just bursts through. Doesn't really look that much like a fly, as impressive as Wallace and his team did that makeup.
They linger on that shot. They linger on his face crumbling and falling off the flesh, his eyeballs oozing out of their sockets. What an incredible piece of special
all
effects.
All practical.
We gave so many compliments to The Thing when we covered that film. It has very similar idea, the way that they carried out their special effects. It was all with puppets and models, much like The Fly. But The Fly looks remarkably better. The Thing, great movie. Feels a little silly, though. There's definitely stuff where it's over the top, and it does veer into camp. The person's stomach that opens up and it has teeth, or the guy's head with spider legs. It feels a little bit silly. It's fun. It's great. But This looks how I would imagine it would look for a fly's head to emerge out of a human's face. The eyeball oozing is the thing that I just can't get over. And I understand that you were saying there are plenty of people who think it's too much, think it's over the top, it's too gross. I don't really find it scary. It is gross. And there's lots of films that will gross you out for the sake of grossing you out, but I feel like this movie really earns it.
It does. There are a few scares. One is when he jumps through the window at the abortion clinic. You could see him coming, before the stuntman, I guess, before he gets there. But if you don't know that's coming, that would probably make you jump, especially if you're susceptible to jump scares. But I've seen the movie six or so times, so I knew that was going to happen. There aren't a lot of other jump scare moments, which is good. Cronenberg doesn't rely on that. But it is more about, repulsive kind of feeling, including when his ear falls off, which I was reading that also surprised Gina Davis. And then she hugs him on that side of his face. And then she'd be feeling the weird makeup, it's all it would be, of course, on the side of her head.
The fact that Ronnie, the character, hugs Seth in that moment is such an expression of pure compassion. Mm-hmm. It says so much about their relationship that she overcomes the repulsion of it and the fear of him, because at that point he's done some pretty messed up stuff to her already, and he's scary, then he's strong.
But he's desperate for help. He asks her for help.
And she loves him.
And she loves him, and he really needs it. And just picture somebody who has cancer or was a burn victim. Again, the AIDS thing, even though Cronenberg didn't intend that, was becoming a big thing in the mid-80s. So many other kinds of illness that turn you into something you weren't before, and it may be mean to say it, is disgusting. And for somebody to hug somebody who is oozing out of the side of their head at that moment says a lot about her. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't hard for Davis to play that moment. Just like vomiting on the donuts, which was this mixture of honey and other things that Goldblum had to leave in his mouth. I'm sure it was one of those things, okay, at the very last second when the shot's ready, guys, then you put the stuff in my mouth, quickly touch up my lips, like it hasn't been on there, because it would probably be some drippage, and then which, of course, is what he uses to hurt Stathis later on. But I guess that's what flies do, to liquefy things and then suck it back up. Ugh. But all the sweets around, you just see this mess in his lab, which really isn't as messy as it probably should be. It wasn't that messy when he was just a guy as well. You think it would be for somebody who's probably not focused on that kind of stuff. He doesn't have time to think about what he's going to wear in a given day, but he has time to have a relatively tidy lab.
I more want to know who bought the donuts. Did he go to the store?
Could have sent out for that kind of stuff. Leave it at the doorway, and then they go away, and he just opens it up.
There it is.
And he must have grants, and maybe he had money. He doesn't really talk about how he got his money to do any of this, but maybe he had a rich family as well.
He does. He says that there's a company that's banking him. Okay, and that he just doesn't have to be all that expensive, so they just leave him alone.
Right.
And she says something to the effect of, aren't you upset that they're going to get all the credit for your work? And he's like, no, I don't care. Until he does care, of course.
Yeah, he would want the credit, but he'd also obviously be proud to know that this ever existed, if the teleports worked. There'd probably be a part of him, even if he got screwed in the deal, that would still say, but I did that. But it wouldn't be enough, you're right. If he didn't turn into a fly, there'd be part of him that'd always be angry about that.
And they give the impression that his character at the beginning of the film is a man who is really singularly obsessed with his work. And Ronnie is the one who brings him out of his shell. They fall in love, and then he kind of has to emerge into the world, and that happens to coincide with him also undergoing these changes and turning into a fly, which changes his personality significantly too, and the two coincide. But it's appropriate that, you know, at the beginning of the film, he's a man who is completely tunnel vision obsessed with this project. And how does the film end? It ends with him literally becoming physically blended with the object that he was creating, that they become merged into one thing.
Existence plays with that a little bit too, doesn't it?
I remember people carry guns in their guts.
Well, and also Videodrome, he pulls out a videotape from his belly, which is only a few years before this, Videodrome with James Woods.
There's a deleted scene in History of Violence where Ed Harris has a gun in his gut as well, in like a dream sequence that ended up getting cut from the film.
Okay.
Cronenberg clearly has fascination with people storing the objects in their torso.
So Goldblum, of course, very committed in this role. I watched the Oscar speech by Wallace and his cohort. I forget his name right now, but I will link to that on the website. They each thanked Jeff Goldblum for putting up with the pounds and pounds of makeup he had to wear, which wasn't that common back then. And of course, now you don't have to wear as much makeup because they can do so much with digital and that kind of thing. But we've covered Goldblum in Jurassic Park and the Grand Budapest Hotel earlier this year, and now this movie. I think that's just those three. But if there's more, I forget what the other ones are right now, but that's an interesting threesome right there where they're all quite different, even though Jeff Goldblum really effectively usually just plays through most of his career Jeff Goldblum. But this is more of a fleshed out, pun intended, real performance. And then Gina Davis, we've covered her in Tootsie, very small role in that for the AFI's list. Thelma Louise and A League of Their Own, two excellent performances in back-to-back years. And I would put this not quite in the same class, But it's nice to see her doing something different in this, though, too, because she's nothing like the Thelma Louise character, who also evolves in the span of one movie, who has a really big arc in that, even more than Susan Sarandon does. And they were dating, these two. It's good that she was as tall as she is, because if she was as short as Joy Bouchel, it'd be weird because Goldblum is so towering and Bouchel is so small. Probably a deliberate touch, too, to have the one-night stand be this little girl, but the main girlfriend is basically his height. And then John Getz, who was in The Fly, too, was also in Blood Simple, in a movie we've covered, The Social Network. He's one of, or I guess the main lawyer for Mark Zuckerberg. Cronenberg, we've done three films of his now. The Dead Zone, which you didn't like that much, although I do. And A History of Violence, which you both like quite a bit. You picked it for The Month of Bev a couple years ago. The Body Horror Guy, The Horror Guy. I remember Scorsese said many years ago that he doesn't think Cronenberg understands his own films. I guess when Cronenberg talks about them and what he thinks they're about, he's one of those people that does commentaries and sits down for interviews more than a lot of other people do and explains what he thinks, unlike Kubrick or Lynch. Lynch will do that, but you learn nothing about what he actually thinks about his movies. But Cronenberg has put together quite a body of work. He hasn't made a movie in quite a long time now. But then again, I was looking him up just to check this, and he has something in development. But it's been 7 years and counting since he made something. And he is in his 70s, I believe, now, and doesn't need to do any more. He's done so many excellent films, mostly not that well known, unless you're truly a film buff.
Or if you're Canadian.
Yes.
I mean, he's kind of a darling in the Canadian industry because he likes to shoot in Toronto.
Almost always a shot here.
Yeah. There are a lot of filmmakers who work locally or just make strictly Canadian films, and he'll work with them, and he's quite popular here.
He's also directed some of these actors' best performances, Goldblum in this, Jeremy Irons a couple years later in Dead Ringers, which is a terrific movie and a great dual performance. Most of the actors in History of Violence are close to their best, if not at their best, in that film. So he did co-write in a way, but didn't, because he didn't actually sit down and write with Charles Edward Pogue. Cronenberg rewrote the screenplay, and they based it on the short story many years ago by George Langalang, whatever that guy's name is. And the producers, one of them was Mel Brooks, who's uncredited, who also produced the David Lynch movie, The Elephant Man. It says Brooks Films at the start of the movie, but you don't focus on the fact that, oh, that's Mel Brooks, because he didn't want people to think in both these cases, oh, it's the funny guy, the weird guy, the satirist.
He had a brand, and he didn't want to confuse people
with two very serious stories like The Elephant Man and The Fly. But Stuart Kornfeld was the main producer, and he is the basis for Les Grossman, physically at least, that Tom Cruise played in Tropic Thunder. The movie's 185-1. We watched it on Disney Plus, but we do have the DVD. We could have watched it that way. I'm sure the Disney Plus version is better. Cinematographer, the editor, and the composer are Cronenberg regulars. Mark Irwin, this was the last time he worked with Cronenberg. We did The Dead Zone that they worked on together, but that was one of the last ones. This is the last one. And then Irwin went on to do comedies. He shot the Farrelly Brothers' Big Three in the 90s, Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, and There's Something About Mary. Ronald Sanders has cut all the Cronenberg films, I think every single one, and also worked on Coraline, a whole different film, but also weird, and body horror stuff in that, too, even though it's not a thing to do with Cronenberg. And the composer Howard Shore, with this operatic, big, loud score, worked on Lord of the Rings, of course, won Oscars for that. So many Cronenberg films, and also so many Marty Scorsese films, including The Departed, which we covered not that long ago, just a couple of months ago. What do you think of the look, the cutting, and the Shore score? And if I didn't say already, this did become an opera, with Howard Shore doing the book or the libretto,
really?
Whatever they call that.
That's cool. So it was a stage play then in the
libretto?
End.
Libretto? Anyway, whatever it's called.
Yeah. I think the look is great. Cinematography is wonderful. The score, also really like it a lot.
Okay.
The editing, I love for the fact that, like we pointed out, that gets right into the story and it gets right out as soon as it's done. It's an incredibly economical piece of storytelling, which I always really admire. To keep this movie under 90 minutes, kudos. But I do find all Cronenberg films have this weird pace to me that makes it feel
episodic and choppy.
Yes!
Right?
And even just within the scene, he gives the actors too many breaths in between lines or something. Something that an editor really could clean up. If I was in the suite, I would always want to tighten them up. And there's got to be tricks that you can use to make transitions between scenes more smooth. And I blame the director because I do find this is pretty consistent with his work. Although I haven't seen all of his films, I never regret watching a David Cronenberg movie. And even his lesser films are still so interesting and unique.
We didn't mention Scanners, another famous body horror film a couple years before this. The Brood, another body horror film before that. Oh, before we wrap, we got to talk about the rotating set, which has been done in quite a few movies. We've covered at least three of them now that have done this. Actually, maybe four, because you could include 2001 A Space Odyssey in this too, with the scene where Frank is running. But Inception uses a rotating set where the camera's locked off the set and it turns And the person just goes with the flow, but it looks like they're the ones that are actually walking the walls and going upside down. Inception did that. Nightmare on Elm Street did that quite well with two different scenes, particularly where Tina gets killed, but also when the bed is spewing out blood after Johnny Depp gets sucked into it. Well, that was upside down. That's why it looked that way. But I think the very first example of this, one of anyway, is Royal Wedding with Fred Astaire back in the 50s. And we've covered at least three movies, well, four, I guess, of 2001 that have used this type of rotating set. When you don't know what that is, if you're just a film fan, you don't really follow how movies are made, that has to blow you away. Maybe not as much with Inception because it could have been done digitally. It wasn't, but it could have been done digitally. But Nightmare on Elm Street and this, horror films made basically a couple years apart, it works even better than it probably should because I don't think it's that expensive. And it's not like Wes Craven and David Cronenberg where Spielberg and Lucas would have gotten the best people in the world to do this stuff. But it's pretty damn convincing as far as I'm concerned. And it's so cool looking to see somebody walking up walls upside down as they do in The Fly. And of course, she's being dragged up the wall in Nightmare on Elm Street.
Practical effects.
Mm-hmm. I ripped on J.J. Abrams a couple of weeks ago in our Victoria Day grab bag special. But I do like that he likes to do, as does Nolan, who I also ripped on in that episode, practical effects as much as possible and not just focusing on using computers and digital and green screen and everything.
You mentioned earlier just how much this movie wouldn't work if it was made today because they would just do all the special effects digitally. And I've thought about that so much.
I think it would work, but it would just be too obvious that it is an effect rather than that maybe could happen possibly because it looks more real than something that's great example. Yet again, the Star Wars series. They don't do flippy things and leap 60 feet through the air because they couldn't do that when the first three were made. But they do that in the prequels, and I guess probably in the sequels, but especially in the prequels, because Lucas was doing so many things digitally. But those people are supposed to be 20 or 30 years younger, so 20 or 30 years before, and they can do better things, more impressive things. So they date the original great series by doing that.
That's a good point. Visual effects are kind of like puppetry in the sense that there's lots of puppets in movies that look a little bit corny, campy. We covered Gremlins at Christmas time, a movie
Chris Wallace did the puppets for that.
Oh, how about that? Mm-hmm. I'm not complaining about Gremlins, but they look fake. It doesn't look convincing, but that's okay. It really suits that movie and that tone. And then there are movies like The Fly that absolutely knock it out of the park and do something really extraordinary. And I think most special effects are like that too, where most of them are a little bit obvious and they take you a little bit out of the movie. And then there's something like Gollum in Lord of the Rings, which was a really early example of mocap, but there was so much artistry and performance and the technical achievement of Gollum. They actually created a character that transcended special effects. So it could be done if you are working with people who care about it as much as this makeup team cared about making this movie special.
But if you're going to do this movie again, you could do it differently. You don't have to do this. But if you want to achieve the heights this one did, I think you've got to have the love story be as memorable as the effects, or almost as memorable as the effects. Because, yeah, Joe Average comes out of this movie, they're going to be talking about what they saw with the visual effects and being disgusted or freaked out or even scared. But if you're a real film fan, and if you've seen this movie many times like we have, then you're focusing actually more so on the great love story between two people who are dating, really good actors, pretty young at the time, who are so committed to these roles, all these ridiculous things happening around them, especially to Goldblum. But then Davis has to watch this, and she makes you believe that she's really seeing this happen to him. And she cares about him, even though he's going through something sci-fi and strange. And this is our first movie in sci-fi month. But it is fairly quiet and is obviously not big in scope. So few characters. But combining love and horror this way, not so easy. It's like that scene at the end of Forgetting Sarah Marshall, where he has the Dracula love story musical.
Oh, yeah.
Die. 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 I can't. And hey, in this movie, Back to the Fly, when the fly itself, no longer Brundlefly even, but he's turned into this fly combined with the pod, actually, she's got the gun, and it actually takes it in its whatever hand thing, and what do you even call
pincer?
It? Yeah, and puts it to its head. Wow, that is awesome stuff. So, in a way, she's also Kevorkian to him because he wants to die. And why wouldn't he? Because he must be in incredible pain, or it now is in incredible pain.
Another moment that on paper sounds terrible, but in the film you are so invested when that happens.
Yeah, excellent movie. Could have been done in Horror Movie Month, but here we are in Sci-Fi Month. And we'll continue with Sci-Fi Month next week. We'll be talking about a picture from 2001 again. We've done that a lot this year. We've got quite a few more before the year's over. This time it'll be Steven Spielberg's quirky hybrid of his own sensibilities and those of Stanley Kubrick in AI. So The Fly, AI. The coming attraction's opinion question for AI, artificial intelligence, the actual full title. Name the best example of a movie in which they already had a perfect ending, as AI does when David is trapped underwater with the blue fairy. But then the story continues past that perfect ending anyway, for the good or for the bad.
All right. So for the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about AI, artificial intelligence. In the meantime, check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, but hundreds more titles on top of that. And while you're there, leave us a rating and a review. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And you can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code top100project at checkout. It's all one word, top100project. It's not case sensitive. And that will get you a 20% discount.
Two things. One, with both women about going through the pod, Seth, no means no. Especially at the end when he is turning into a fly. And the second thing, the last thing I'll say, I could really go for some donuts right now, and I won't be puking on them.
I'm happy to hear that. And cut.